This is Their Life Story Podcast with Robin Levine. I have always believed that everybody has something to teach all of us. In this series of interviews, I will talk to all types of people in order to learn from and be inspired by them and their life stories. My guest this week is Paul Watson. Paul is the founder of Sea Shepherd, an anti-poaching organization focused on marine conservation. They've become controversial because they ram ships, put themselves between whaling and sealing boats and their prey, and take a more aggressive approach to activism. Sea Shepherd is endorsed by lots of celebrities, including Pierce Brosnan, Martin Sheen, and Pamela Anderson. Sea Shepherd and their efforts to stop the poaching of whales was the subject of the Discovery Channel's show Whale Wars, which ran for 7 seasons. Paul was one of the founding members of Greenpeace, but his desire for more direct action got him voted out by the board of directors. Prior to working at Greenpeace, Paul was a deckhand for the Norwegian Merchant Marine and the Canadian Coast Guard. In this episode, we talk about his upbringing and his 47 years of activism, including stopping the killing of wolves in northern BC and the Yukon, helping to put an end to the market for Canadian seal fur, and sinking half of Spain's whaling fleet. What did you take in school when you were growing up?
Oh, what level you mean?
When you went to university, how did that play into your role as like an activist?
Well, I was forced to drop out of high school because, I was the eldest of 7 children and my mother died in 1964. And I was 13 at the time. And so I ran away from home continuously. And finally, at 17, I left and joined the Norwegian Merchant Marine. And so I spent time there. I was in the Canadian Coast Guard. I entered Simon Fraser University as a mature student and majored in communications and linguistics.
Well, what made you want to go into that?
Well, you know, the understanding that if you want to get your message across, we live in a media culture. If we don't learn how to live within that in that environment, then we're not going to achieve very much. I mean, there's no surprise that Greenpeace, the foundation Greenpeace, was established by journalists and broadcasters and writers and communicators. We realized very early that the camera was a very powerful weapon. And also all the different tricks of the trade if you're going to get your message across. Very early came to the understanding that, the media, every story has like 4 elements, sex, scandal, violence, and celebrity. You have to incorporate those elements if you want to have a story. So, we'll go out, say save the whales, that's fine. But, it's just academic. But if you go out there and risk your life to protect them, then that becomes a story.
Where did you use sex in your campaigns?
Well, as an example, in 1984, I led a campaign to stop the killing of wolves in northern British Columbia, the Yukon. It was a perfect story. It got us the headlines in Canada for, I'd say 2 whole solid weeks. And the reason being is we had all 4 elements because they were shooting wolves, which was violent. They were threatening to shoot us. That was violent. We had an environment minister who was taking a bribe from being game hunters, and we exposed that. So we had violence and scandal. So I recruited Bo Derek as our spokesperson for the campaign. And at that press conference, one reporter said, come on, what does Bo Derek know about saving wolves? I said, well, that's not the point. You guys set the rules. We just play the game. If I had the best wolf biologists in the world here, Dr. Gordon Haver, Dr. David Meck, be an empty room. Nobody would be covering it. But this will be the front page story of the Vancouver Sun tomorrow. And there's not a damn thing you can do about it, is there? And of course, that's where it was. This is one of the reasons our Sea Shepherd's board of advisors include people like Pierce Brosnan and Sean Connery and Christian Bale and William Shatner and Christophe Lambert and Richard Dean Anderson, because I say, we can't lose. We got 2 James Bonds. We got Batman. We got Captain Kirk, and we got the Highlander and MacGyver.
Wow. You must be really proud of yourself for starting something that got all these amazing people and all these passionate volunteers together on the same cause. Is that your life achievement?
No, my life achievement, I think, is building a movement, which is now in 42 different countries to protect marine wildlife and diversity. And, you know, we utilize all those different, well, celebrities are very helpful in getting our message across. But our objective really is to defend marine life by upholding international conservation law. We're an anti-poaching organization, really. We're not a protest group.
How did you realize that being on Greenpeace, and you volunteered a lot in your earlier years, how did you realize that those weren't effective and that you had to go about it actively?
Well, after 7 years with Greenpeace, I came to the realization that protesting was very submissive. It's like, please, please, please don't kill the whales. And they do it, and all they do is hang banners and take pictures. You know, it doesn't stop it. And the establishment that we live in, you know, is conditioned to deal with this. They know how to deal with nonviolent civil disobedience. And they ended up just arresting people, and then people get a criminal record, and they can't do anything, you know, after that because they've been compromised. So there had to be another way of dealing with that. And so I set Sea Shepherd up to intervene and not to protest. And we operate within the boundaries of both practicality and the law. I mean, it's been 42 years. I've not been convicted of any felony anywhere. And we've never injured anybody. We've never sustained any injuries. So we have an unblemished record in that regard. But we have shut down literally hundreds and hundreds of illegal activities around the world.
Isn't it crazy that we live in a world where the government isn't doing that and they're taking bribes, and there has to be a controversial activism organization like yourself that has to do it? Like, why are they taking bribes? Like, what are they thinking?
I think history has demonstrated that governments are essentially corrupt, and they're driven by greed and by power. Governments cause problems. They don't solve problems. And if you look at any social revolution in the history of humanity, it's always been carried out by the passion, the courage, and the initiative of an imagination of individuals. Slavery wasn't ended by Abraham Lincoln. It was ended by the passion of Wilberforce and Douglas and women, you know, who fought to get the right to vote. They didn't get any help from politicians. They, you know, they made the sacrifices and they achieved that victory. Same with the civil rights movement and all the various movements throughout history. It has to come from the people. It does. Government, by the time you get into a position to be a politician or a world leader, you've been so compromised that you pretty much can't do anything.
So the best way to do it is a grassroots approach, you've found?
Always, yes. Or, you know, you build a movement, and a movement, you know, you can stop an individual, you can even stop an organization, but you can't stop a movement. And what is a movement? An environment, the strength of an ecosystem is in diversity. Therefore, the strength of any movement has to be in diversity. So the approach can be either litigation or legislation or education or direct intervention. It really depends upon the imagination of the people involved. But all of those approaches work towards the same objective. And even though sometimes they seem to disagree and, you know, various factions, well, I'm going to do education, therefore, whatever you're doing in the realm of direct action is wrong. And people who are doing direct action say, oh, education is useless. The reality of it is that it all contributes towards the same objective.
Yeah, it's really inspiring for me. I've thought about going into politics before, and I'm like, by the time I got into a position of power, it's probably too late for the cause I want to speak up for anyway. It's just such a long thing.
Well, the problem with politics is, you know, as you climb to the top, you owe favors constantly. And that's why we never get any real decent leaders. I mean, here in the United States, you got 300 million people, and look what we got running for president, Joe Biden and Donald Trump, because by the time anybody gets into that position, anybody who really wants to make a difference is not going to get into a position to be president of the United States. And the only reason Justin Trudeau is prime minister is because of his father. But essentially, he's just as useless as Trump. He says the right things, but you know, he hasn't done anything really. You know, at the COP21 conference in Paris, everybody loved Justin. He's going to save the world. Well, he went out and instead began to save the oil companies and the pipelines and the tar sands. You know, most politicians are in the pockets of the corporations.
Are there any politicians you do like?
Well, the Green Party in Australia or Canada, yeah, but they're not in power. But We work with various governments in the world, but they're usually all third world governments. Sea Shepherd is in partnership with Liberia and Tanzania and Namibia and Sao Tome and Gabon and Mexico. But these are governments that need our help because their resources are plundered by European and Asian nations. And they've been helpless to deal with that. So we provide the resources and the volunteers, and they provide the authority, which allows us to intervene. So just this last year, we've arrested over 52 poachers in West African waters. I'm quite confident that if it wasn't for our efforts in Mexico over the last 7 years, the endangered Bikita porpoise would now be extinct. We've confiscated about 1,200 illegal nets and have actually kept the poachers out of the Bikita refuge. I mean, it's a dangerous campaign. We get shot at, our drones get shot down, we have Molotov cocktails thrown at us. And we're in partnership with the Mexican Navy, so they even attack the Mexican Navy when they're alongside us.
So does it feel like a war sometimes?
Well, it is a war. It's a war to protect this planet. I always say it's a war with ourselves to defend ourselves from ourselves, really. It's human greed and is really the enemy. I mean, the problem is the world, the social economics, political system that we live in is all based on short-term investment for short-term gain without any real consideration as to the consequences in the future. And it's also, we're constantly adapting to diminishment. As things become more diminished, we just sort of accept that and move on to the next stage. A good example, if this was the 60s and I were to say to you that in 40 years you'd be buying water in plastic bottles and paying more for that water, the equivalent amount of gasoline, you'd look at me like I was insane. Nobody would do that. But yet we've adapted to that diminishment.
Yeah, that's a really good example. That's a perfect example.
And, you know, species of fish, which were once plentiful, are no longer. We just forget they were there and then move on to other species. Like, for instance, turbot. In the 60s, that was considered like a garbage fish. You know, people didn't have the taste people wanted. And they basically threw them away, which was pretty bad in itself. But today, that's the fish you get in the best restaurants in Paris and New York, because all the more valuable species have been diminished.
I was just reading that about mink whales yesterday, because they were the smallest whale and they didn't used to get hunted, but now they're kind of the only one that you can hunt because there's not too many of the rest.
Yeah, except that they were still hunting fin whales until 2 years ago, and hopefully that'll be ended. But they're also going after Baird's beak whales and a few other species in Japanese waters, but the Norwegians concentrate mainly on minke whales.
What has been like a really big success of your guys' where you feel like you stopped people from killing whales and you saved a huge amount of lives of whales or other animals too?
Well, our campaigns to protect the whales in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary from 2005 until 2 years ago were successful. Japan was driven out. They're no longer killing whales down there, and the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary is now 100% protected. And in the process, we prevented them from killing about 6,500 whales. So it was a long campaign, but it was one of our more successful campaigns. We also were able to stop the toothfish poachers in the Southern Ocean. In 1 year, we shut all their operations down, six major vessels. One of them was ended up with the longest pursuit in maritime history, 110-day pursuit from the coast of Antarctica to equatorial West Africa. And after 110 days, the captain of that vessel called the Thunder sank his own ship in order to, because he had nowhere to go. And he sank it in order to destroy the evidence. But our crew boarded the sinking ship, got the evidence, and he and two officers ended up going to prison for 3 years.
Wow, that's amazing. 110 days? How many people were on your guys' ship that followed him for 110 days?
Well, we had about 30 on each ship, so it was about 60 crew during that time.
Wow.
And the Sam Simons job, the Bob Barker was chasing the Thunder for those 110 days. The Sam Simons job was to confiscate the net they dropped when the chase began. So our crew spent 200 hours pulling in 72 kilometers of gill nets that weighed 70 tons. And then they caught up and the two ships then pursued the Thunder.
And these gill nets, they're the worst way possible to fish. They're even worse than the draggers.
Oh, well, there's gill nets, there's drip nets, there's purse seine nets, there's dragger, bottom drawlers, midwater drawlers. They're all very destructive. But the toothfish gill nets, they're set 2 kilometers down on the bottom of the water. on the surface, and then they stay there, and then they pull them up. And but the problem with them is they take everything, not just the targeted fish, but pretty much everything. And the amount of nets that are being set in the world is absolutely incredible. If you take all of the nets, gill nets, long lines, and everything, put them together, probably encircle the planet about 3 or 4 times.
Why can people get away with this? Is it because not very many people know what's happening?
Well, most of the world is in a state of lawlessness in the up beyond national jurisdictions. They can do whatever they want. There are treaties and rules and regulations, but everybody just ignores those. That's one of the reasons we can get away with doing what we're doing, because we're operating in really the Wild West, a global Wild West, I guess. And so if they come after us, sometimes, oh, then charge us. If you can charge us, why can't you charge these guys? You know, what's your problem? And of course they don't. For instance, 1986, I sank half of Iceland's whaling fleet and destroyed their whale processing plant. That was a $17 million hit, and it shut them down for 17 years. And they said, well, that's illegal. Well, it wasn't really illegal, because I flew to Reykjavik and demanded to be arrested, and they refused to arrest me. And the Minister of Justice says, who the hell does he think he is? He comes into our country and demands to be arrested. Get him out of here. So was that illegal? I mean, they had the opportunity to charge me, but they didn't, because they knew that to put me on trial would be to put themselves on trial. Yeah. I mean, we've been taken to court many times, but we've won in all those cases. We freed 800 bluefin tuna from nets in off the coast of Libya from a Maltese trawler. They took us to court in Scotland. I actually had my vessel impounded in Scotland, and we put up a bond to get it out. And then we had 2 years of fighting, and we won the case. Their lawyer said, well, we'll just keep throwing money at it until we destroy Sea Shepherd. And they took it to the Court of Appeals in Great Britain, and they won. And then we went to the Supreme Court, and we won. And they ended up having to give us $1.5 million in damages.
Wow. It seems like it ends up in court, like things you do end up in court a lot. Is that stressful for you, or is it annoying, or how do you feel about it?
It's all part of the process. Courtrooms are just an extension of the battles on the ocean, really. And, also when you go into court, you have to go in properly armed. For instance, in 1993, I was arrested for for chasing the Spanish and Cuban drag trawlers off of the Grand Banks of Newfoundland. And Canada arrested me for that, even though it was beyond 200 miles. And I was charged in a Newfoundland court. And I was charged with two counts of mischief endangering life and one count of mischief endangering property. So under Canadian law, I was facing 2 times life plus 10 years in prison for that. Now, I didn't damage anything and I didn't hurt anybody, but the possibility was there. So that's what that's why they use the mischief charge. Usually mischief and conspiracy are the two things they use when they haven't anything really substantial to go after you with. But anyway, I had a jury trial, and my first reaction to that was I called Marvin Storo, a lawyer that I knew in Vancouver. And I said, Marvin, who's the best damn lawyer in Newfoundland? He said, that's Brian Casey. Got those priests up on the orphanage scandal. I said, well, he's my guy. Brian was an artist. I mean, here was his opening statement in our trial. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'm not going to say we didn't do what we're charged with. I'm going to say that we did exactly what we're charged with, and we intend to do it again. And that was our opening statement, and we won the case.
That's amazing to win a case going in saying, yeah, I was guilty, I'm going to do it again, and then still win the case.
It's all about getting the best lawyer you can find.
We want the guy who got the priests off? That's so funny.
Guys, those guys were pretty much guilty of sin.
That's, yeah, what a world, the law world. Can you tell me some stories about you personally, like missions that you've been on and like experiences that you've had, and what it's like when you're out there on the boats and you're on the front lines, or even just like some fun times, or just anything that comes to mind?
Oh, I don't know. I've been doing these things for 40 years. It's even longer, because I was with Greenpeace for 7 years like that. So, it's all become a routine, really, going to sea and all the various areas. I mean, we've gone everywhere in fact, we've gone further south than any other vessel on the planet. In 1 year down in the Southern Ocean, we ventured into the Bay of Whales, and there's one point there that nobody had ever gone that far south anywhere on the globe, and we were actually able to achieve that. There's a Russian cruise ship that claims that credit, but when we were down there, said there's no way that this guy got as far as we did. He's just lying, because the draft is such that that vessel wouldn't have made it. But it has been quite adventurous in all of these campaigns. I mean, we've weathered typhoons and storms and gone through hundreds and hundreds of miles of ice and broke through it and had chases and confrontations. We've been attacked many times. We've been shot at many times. But like I said, we've never sustained any injuries.
What's it like when you get shot at? What's going through your brain when somebody's shooting at you?
Well, in confrontation situations, nothing really. You when you're in a confrontation situation, you react. You don't really let anything else bother you. You just sort of react to the environment that you're in, and you make the decisions that you need in order to deal with the situation. Whether that ends up with the collisions with the ships, or avoiding collisions, or deliberately ramming somebody if you have to. You have to make those decisions up as you can. In 1979, I went after a pirate whaling vessel called the Sierra, and I went across the Atlantic. I found it about 200 miles off the coast of Portugal, and I could have rammed it and disabled it, and that was my objective. But it was very rough seas, and I didn't want to injure anybody. So I chased that vessel for 200 miles into the northern Portuguese port of Lixos. And it was in the harbor, and I came up alongside the dock, and I gave my crew an opportunity. I said, look, we're going to go out, and we're going to ram that vessel. I'm going to put it in its career right now. Now, I can't say you're not going to get hurt, but I can guarantee you'll probably go to jail for this. So if you got your choice, but you got to make it in the next 10 minutes. You're the part of it. And if not, then I want you on the dock with your stuff and off the boat, because we're going out there. So 10 minutes later, 17 of them were on the dock, and only two crew stayed with me. Fortunately, they were engineers. And so we went out, and I went full speed towards the Sierra. I struck it in the bow to damage the harpoon, did a 360 around it, and hit it midships to open it up to the waterline, really just sliced it right open. And then they started their engines up and limped into port, and we took off to sea, but we were pursued by the Portuguese Navy, and we were brought back. And I was brought before the port captain, charged with gross criminal negligence. But I said to the port captain that there wasn't anything negligent about what we did. I hit that vessel exactly where I intended to hit it. That wasn't negligent. And he laughed, but he also said, I don't know who owns that boat until I find out. You're free to go. And when I walked out the door, one of my crew members who had gotten off, he said, well, if I knew you were going to get away with it, I would have been there too. Well, sometimes you got to do things when there's no way to get away with it. So ended up the Sierra ended up being repaired at a cost of over $1 million to them. And then as soon as it was repaired, we blew the bottom out of it and sunk it in Lisbon Harbor, and therefore ended its career forever.
Oh my God, they must hate you.
Well, I don't know. Then a month later, we sank half of Spain's whaling fleet in Vigo Harbor in Spain. And it was about 3 months later, I met Juan Carlos, the owner of Juan Massa. I mean, he was the owner of the Spanish fleet, and he was at the International Whaling Commission in London, and or was it Bournemouth, England. And I walked up to him and introduced myself, and I said, we sank half your fleet, you son of a bitch. And he didn't know what to do. So,
do you feel confrontational? Like sometimes, do you get in a lot of confrontational situations with politicians and reporters and boat owners and company representatives?
I've getting confrontation mainly with fishermen on the or sealers or whalers. Yeah,
the sealers look like a pretty pissed off bunch of people.
They're always amusing, because they can always be counted on to act stupidly.
So they just want to go up and club the cute little seals for their valuable white fur, and then you guys were getting in front of boats and you were dyeing the seal pelts red or green or different colors so that it wasn't worth anything.
But we also blockaded St. John's Harbor for 2 weeks and prevented them from leaving. And we chased them out of the Gulf of St. Lawrence. We did a lot of various tactics on that. But the whole point was to bring a lot of attention to this. But our ultimate objective is what was achieved by 2008, which was the European Union banning all seal products from Canada.
So do people still seal hunt now?
They do.
White people that aren't supposed to?
There still is a commercial seal hunt in Canada because the Canadian government supports it, and the quota is 450,000 a year. But they don't take that many because there's no market. We've destroyed the markets. So the sealers go out there, and the only reason they can continue to do it is because of heavy subsidies by the Canadian government. But there's nowhere to sell the product. So Canada is basically, it's a glorified welfare scheme right now, which takes about 40,000 seals a year instead of 450,000.
Wow. What you've been able to accomplish is so amazing. It's like, it's a huge accomplishment. And I think a lot of times you get vilified because of your tactics. But if you just think of like the populations of tons of different species that you guys have stopped from being critically endangered, it's pretty miraculous.
Yeah, well, we don't do this for people, so we're not really concerned about the criticism. You know, our clients are all of those species that live in the ocean. You know, in 1986, again, after we sank the half of the Iceland's whaling fleet, I had a former colleague from Greenpeace say to me, well, I just want to let you know that what you did in Iceland was reprehensible, unforgivable, and you're an embarrassment to the movement. I said, yeah, well, so we didn't do it for you. Didn't do it for the movement. We didn't do it for any human being on the planet. Find me a whale that disagreed with what we did, and we might reconsider.
Can you tell me about the time that whale almost fell on your boat when it was being harpooned and it looked you in the eye? Because I think that was very significant in your life and your being so steadfast on your mission.
Well, that was in 1975 when I was a first officer on the Greenpeace voyage. And we'd come up with this idea to protect the whales by putting our bodies between the whales and the harpoon. And we were reading a lot of Gandhi at the time. We thought that was to go about it. So Bob Hunter and I found ourselves in a small inflatable vessel in front of a Soviet harpoon vessel that was bearing down on us. And every time the harpooner tried to get a shot at these eight magnificent sperm whales that were in front of us, I maneuvered the boat to block the harpoon. And that was clearly frustrating him. And then he didn't shoot. And then the captain on that boat came running down the gangway, the catwalk, and screamed into his ear and looked down at us, smiled, and brought his finger across his throat. And that's when I realized that Gandhi wasn't going to work that day. There was a horrendous explosion. The harpoon flew over our head, slammed into the back of one of the whales in the pod. It was a female, and she rolled on her side. She screamed, and the largest whale in the pod suddenly slapped the water with his tail and dove, swam right underneath of us, and threw himself up at the bow of the Soviet vessel. But they were waiting for him with an unattached harpoon, and the harpooner fired again. This whale screamed in agony, fell back in the water, was rolling about, thrashing about on the surface, and I caught his eye, and I saw him dive again. And this time I saw a trail of bloody bubbles coming at us real fast, and he came up and out of the water at an angle so that the next move would be to come down and crush us. And as his head rose out of the water and I looked into his eye, which was right there, so close I could see my own reflection in his eye, I saw something, I felt something, I felt understanding. I felt that the whale understood what we were trying to do, because I could see the effort he made to pull himself back, and his head began to slide back into the sea and his eye disappeared beneath the surface, and he died. So he could have killed us and chose not to do so. So I'm personally indebted to the fact that that whale chose to spare my life. But as we were sitting there in the midst of the Soviet whaling fleet about 60 miles off the coast of California, and the sun was setting, I said to myself, why are we killing these whales? And you didn't eat sperm whale meat. You made oil out of them. And that oil is very highly prized, especially spermaceti oil, as for high heat resistant lubricating oil. And one of the things that it was very highly prized for was for the manufacture of intercontinental ballistic missiles. And I said to myself, here we are destroying this incredibly intelligent, beautiful, self-aware, socially complex, sentient being for the purpose of making a weapon meant for the mass extermination of human beings. And that's when it just struck me that we're insane. We're just absolutely insane, certainly ecologically insane. And I said, from that moment on, I don't do that. I don't do what I do for people. I do it for them. And I don't, so that makes me immune to criticism. I really just don't care what people say about what we do.
You must have seen more destruction of beautiful creatures than anybody, like being right there and watching people take the fins off sharks and throw them back into the ocean and clubbing the seals right in front of you. The stuff you've seen is pretty shocking.
By the way, I wouldn't say more than anybody. The people who do it are probably seeing more than I.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, we encounter some vicious, very vicious people that were out there, you know, people who are so alienated from the natural world that they can commit these atrocities without their conscience bothering them.
How do you think those people justify it to themselves?
I think human beings can justify anything that they're making money.
Yeah. Do you feel like even the people you're arguing, like the law authority figures that are sticking up for the fishermen, they're justifying it for the wrong reasons too? And you can't really trust them either because there's so much money behind it in the long run?
Well, the enforcement people, they do what the government tells them to do. And the government, they do what they think is best politically. And since the seal hunt in Canada is really just about, for instance, about getting boats in Newfoundland, that's all that concerns the politicians. So. You know, so the politician, you know, they tell the Mounties what to do. But again, the problem is that the fisheries officers and the Mounted police, they're always more sympathetic to the fishermen, just like they're always more sympathetic to workers in strikes and everything. They do what they're told. They're basically just soldiers, but they do what they're told. I mean, if we had a government in power that was more compassionate, most likely the authorities would be more compassionate. But, you know, if they were told to do that.
Have you had much experience with narwhals and beluga whales?
Well, we did stop the capture of beluga whales in James Bay many, many years ago. Not with narwhals, I've had no experience with other than criticizing the shooting of them. But, you know, and that always gets us in trouble with some of the Inuit communities and everything. But
yeah,
the problem is that there's very few Aboriginal communities left that actually are really, truly Aboriginal. You know, once they get involved in the trade of furs and ivory with the European world or whatever with the white culture, then they become incorporated into that culture. You know, the trapping animals for fur was sort of normal, I guess, for Native Americans, but trapping animals for fur to the brink of extinction became what they were involved in when they became associated with the Hudson Bay Company and the, you know, and the various other fur companies. So, you know, our problem is that when we oppose these commercial operations, then the government uses the Aboriginal communities against us. And for instance, there's not a single Aboriginal person involved with the commercial seal hunt on the east coast of Canada, but they're constantly making it sound like we're driving people in the high north to suicide and drug use and alcoholism, when not a single one of them is involved in that. And nobody has ever gone up and intervened against the Inuit on the seal and on their killing of seals. The quota for the commercial hunt, like I said, was 450,000 when we were actively involved. It could be anywhere from 127,000 to 250,000 a year. But the whole entire quota for the Inuit is 10,000. So, you know, it's insignificant compared to the commercial operations, but the government of Canada would have everybody believe that this is all part of the Inuit community.
Yeah, I just read a quote by you that says the media, they're all about making a frontline quote and saying one thing, and then they'll tell you the truth and the back pages a few days later, but no one reads those back pages. They'll just say whatever they need to say on the front page.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, that got twisted around when I said that originally. He said, oh, Paul Watson says it doesn't matter what's true. And you know, it only matters what blah, blah, blah. And I go, no, that's what Ronald Reagan said, you know, is that it doesn't matter what you say, because it will be reported as fact, and any retraction will then be reported a few days later in the back page of the newspaper, and nobody's going to see it. I was using that as an example of how politicians do it. But of course, that gets twisted around and says, Paul Watson says that this is what you have to do. I said, that's not what we have to do. That's what is being done.
Do you find your notoriety or your fame has helped you or hurt you over the last long period of your life?
Well, it always helps because, you know, if you have a high profile, that gives you a certain level of protection. It certainly gives you more support. So it certainly isn't a negative factor.
Do you have a favorite animal or favorite species?
I don't have any favorites anything.
Do you still have one Interpol red notice on you?
I just have one left. There to show you how political it was. The Costa Ricans dropped theirs last year with a change of government. If it was really judicial, they wouldn't have been able to do that. If it was political, they could do it. You know, the Interpol red notice is set up for major war criminals, major drug traffickers, and serial killers. And I'm the only person who's ever been put on the red notice for trespassing. And so you don't just don't get on that. But Japan's got a lot of clout and a lot of pull, and we've cost them a lot of money. And so they put me on there. And they got Costa Rica to put me on it, but Costa Rica backed off when they with the change of government. And Japan doesn't really want me extradited to Japan. They just want to make it inconvenient for me to travel, because they know if I go somewhere that I could be detained and whatever. But I've actually gone to the Japanese embassy, or had my lawyers go to the Japanese embassy here in the United States and say, okay, do you want me and where do you want me? And they don't respond. They don't respond. They have not applied for extradition in the United States, even though I'm here. But they've made it clear to Canada, and Canada's made it clear to me that if I were to go into Canada, I would be detained and extradited to Japan. But that's just a way for Canada to keep me out of Canada.
Wow. It seems like very politically like tangled web. It seems kind of confusing.
All political. It's always political.
What is Japan up to? What are they doing with bluefin? I think I saw in your documentary, Watson, that they're hoarding bluefin. They have like 15 years worth of bluefin tuna. And then they just keep overfishing them and overfishing them, because the less of them they are, the more they can sell them for.
Yeah, it's called the economics of extinction, and almost all the fishing industries are involved with that. It's always short-term investment for short-term gain. Let's get as much out of the ocean as possible and take that profit, put it somewhere else. I mean, Mitsubishi is not in the fishing industry. That's just one conglomerate sort of thing they're involved in. Started out making weapons. Now they're doing this, that, and the other. But here's the problem. They do have 10 to 15 years supply of bluefin tuna in their warehouses. And they could stop fishing it today and still supply their market and allow the bluefin tuna population to recover. But if the bluefin tuna population recovers, the price of their fish in their warehouses will go down. And it's already the most expensive fish on the planet. So, and if the bluefin goes extinct, then what they have in their warehouses is now priceless. So they can set their own price on that. So there's profits to be made from driving species extinct. Elephants are being killed and their ivory is being stored in vaults in Japan and China, because the fewer elephants, the greater the value of the ivory. And if elephants were to go extinct, it becomes a priceless commodity. So, you know, they want it. They're literally looking at causing diminishment. It's part of their whole economic plan.
But if we live in a world with people with morals like that, how are we not screwed?
We've always lived in a world with people like morals like that. I mean, look at slavery and the treatment of Native Americans and the treatment of people just generally, let alone the animals. The human species has been a ruthless exterminator of other species and of other human beings. I mean, that's been our history. The real problem here is this. There's a sickness, which I call anthropocentrism. And originally, we were biocentric people like many indigenous people are today. That means biocentrism means we're part of everything. We live in harmony with all other species. And we know who we are. Anthropocentrism is an alienation from the natural world, where we've decided that we're more important than any other species, that we're dominant over all other species, that we've become a bunch of overly conceited naked apes who are divine legends in our own mind, really. We've created these delusions, which we call religions, which to me are just collective mass psychosis, and which has no basis in reality at all. So, but this to me is a sickness that began with the development of agriculture about 8,000 years ago, and has led to hierarchical situations and this incredible insane greed that drives economies today.
Yeah, it's shocking. It makes me just feel like we're not going to win the war with climate change.
We will. It's not that we will. The planet will. Because there are three basic laws of ecology: the law of diversity, the law of interdependence, and the law of finite resources. No species can survive outside of those three basic laws of ecology. And therefore, there will be consequences. So it's happening already. And, you know, we're not very successful as a species. We haven't been around that long. And I don't think we're going to be around that much longer unless we learn to live in harmony with all the other species. They're more important than we are. And when I say that, people get really outraged. How can you say that worms and trees and insects and viruses are more important than we are? Well, I can say that because for the very simple reason that they live here with it. They can live here quite comfortably without us, but we can't live without them. We need them. They don't need us. So we're going to see more and more consequences happening. COVID-19 right now, I've been predicting this for some time. That's just a harbinger of worse pandemics to come. And the reason these pandemics are going to happen, and they have been happening, but not really noticed because they haven't been as devastating. You know, we've had Ebola and West Nile fever and Hanta virus and SARS and MERS and everything, but it's going to get, they always get worse. And the reason they get worse is diminishment of ecosystems and diminishment of species causes zoonotic transmission of viruses, and also the release of pathogens that have been dormant in the permafrost for 40, 50,000 years. That's happening now too. Wow. And how this happens is that every plant and every animal has viruses that are associated with it. They're absolutely essential. We could not survive on this planet without viruses. We need them. You know, they have a function that are absolutely necessary for our survival. Now, the problem is when you diminish an ecosystem or diminish a species, those species which are closer related to us, whether that be primates or bats or whatever, the viruses associated with those species have to go somewhere. And we're very attractive. There's 8 billion of us. So they're going to jump. And they're going to, that's called zoonotic transmission. They're going to jump to us. And here's the problem. A virus doesn't want to, well, it doesn't consciously, but it really, viruses aren't there to kill you. But they are there to establish a situation of coexistence because you're the host and they don't want to kill the host. But in order to establish that coexistence, a lot of hosts have to die until they can find the immunity that can allow for that coexistence. So in every major pandemic throughout history, that has been the case. I mean, the reason we don't get the bubonic plague today is because we're the descendants of all of the survivors who had immunity. You know, and so that's how you beat it. But it costs a lot to do that. But there's a better way to beat it, and that is to not create the situations which causes zoonotic transmissions. So if you really wanted to address COVID-19, well, then let's start addressing the preservation of our ecosystems and preservation of species.
How come not everyone gets that?
Well, I think virologists now get it and anthropologists get it. I mean, but, you know, people, don't, you know, the average person has no idea what a virus does or what the use of it. Here's another thing. Since 1950, we've had a 40% diminishment in phytoplankton populations in the world, in the ocean. Phytoplankton provides up to 70% of the oxygen in the air we breathe. That means there's been a diminishment in oxygen because of that. If phytoplankton were to go extinct, we all die. We don't live on this planet without phytoplankton. In fact, most life forms would go. So when they say we're in the sixth major extinction, what that means is we're going to lose more species of plants and animals between the year 2000 and the year 2065 than we've lost in the last 65 million years. So this has actually got a name, the Anthropocene, which because we're responsible for that. There's been 5 major extinctions prior to this one. The Permian extinction wiped out 97% of everything in the ocean. But what did all of those mass extinctions have in common? It took 15 to 20 million years for a full recovery. So whatever we do, 15 to 20 million years from now, this planet will be a really nice place again. We just won't be here. It doesn't matter. We can't destroy the planet, but we can destroy ourselves, and we can take a lot of other species with us. So really, this whole conservation movement is about protecting humanity from humanity.
Yeah, it's really bringing me down thinking about how stupid we are, even just for our own sake. The worse we are to nature, it has a huge effect on us, and the worse our lives are. Like, it sucks having COVID in the world now. Like, life sucks now with COVID. And that's our fault.
Yeah, but you should read, Lori Garrett's book, The Coming Plague, which was written in 1995. She predicted all of this. It's going to get worse. But how do you get keep from being depressed? I learned a lesson many years ago. In 1973, I was a medic with the American Indian Movement during the occupation of Wounded Knee in South Dakota. And we were surrounded by 3,000 federal agents. They were shooting at us. They killed 2 people. They wounded 46. And we had no way of winning. The odds were against us. I went to Russell Means, who was a leader of the American Indian Movement. I said, well, what are we doing here? We can't win. The odds are against us. And he said, well, we're not concerned about the odds, and we're not concerned about winning or losing. We're here because this is the right place to be, the right time to do it, and the right thing to do. Focus on the present. Don't worry about the future. Don't stress about the future. What you do today will define what the future will be. And that's all you can really do. So if you want to control the future, you do it through your actions in the present. And so I don't really get overwhelmed by what's going to be. I can only focus on what I'm doing.
It must really help to keep you sane and focused when you're like, when you're involved in those big boat journeys and even just up against all types of political arguments all the time.
Yeah. Well, it does, but also by being in the natural world, going through, being down to Antarctica and going through the ice and seeing all these incredible things and everything, you come to the realization that, we're not that important. We shouldn't just be so full of ourselves, that there's so many other more important species. And, look at the Earth as a spaceship, which is what it is, really. We're on this incredible trip around the Milky Way galaxy. And every spaceship has a life support system. And that life support system provides us with the air we breathe and the food we eat and regulates climate and temperature. And that life support system is run by a crew. We're not crew members. We're passengers. We're having a wonderful time entertaining ourselves. We're sitting there at the buffet just gorging ourselves. Meanwhile, down in the engine room of Spaceship Earth, the crew are doing all the work, maintaining that life support system. Now, the problem is we're killing the crew. And there's only so many crew members you can kill before the machinery begins to fall apart. There's nothing there to maintain it. And so when we cut down the trees and we destroy the worms and the bacteria and the phytoplankton and the fishes, we're destroying the crew members that run the machinery that supports the life support system for the planet. And of course, supports us. So whatever we do to other species, we are ultimately doing to ourselves.
I completely agree. On a more uplifting note, what comes to mind when you think of some of the more beautiful things you've seen, like as you've traveled the world?
I think the most beautiful places I've ever seen is Antarctica, and I think what makes it so beautiful is the absence of people. I mean, this is the last ecosystem on the planet that's really ruled by non-humans. And they've got these incredible character penguins, they just come right up to you. They're extremely friendly and everything. I was once doing an interview on the ice, and I took a position about 300 meters from a bunch of king penguins because I didn't want to harass them. And while I'm doing the interviews, the king penguins, they just come up and they stand right beside me. They're looking into the camera, looking at me. You just don't see that kind of interrelationship with the wild animals anywhere else other than places like Antarctica.
What have you learned from animals as you go throughout your life?
Well, that that most animals, wild animals, they know what they are. And, they don't take more than they need. Then they know how to control wolf populations, know how to control their populations perfectly. We can learn so much from them. You don't see wolves getting out of control, and that they maintain a very strict regime on how to control their populations. So there's so much we can learn from so many species. But what we're doing is when we destroy them, we destroy beavers, but beavers help shape the ecosystems that we live in, and wolves help shape those ecosystems too. And so we really cause a lot of damage. Every time we do something, we try to correct that problem with something else, and it just never works. If you want to protect the oceans, the best thing to do is leave it alone. Allow the ocean the opportunity to repair the damage that we've done to it. In many cases, all of these things can be solved just by leaving it alone. And that, for thousands of years in Polynesia, the shamans would, they had this thing called kapu. And these were strict laws. And if anybody, it was a death penalty for violating them. People said, well, that's a little extreme. For if a shaman said, no fishing in this bay, it's kapu. And if anybody's caught fishing, it was a death penalty. And the reason for that is that the shamans understood that if the fish disappeared, so did they. Yeah. People would die. Therefore, if they didn't have those rules, then there would be chaos and people would die. So we have no kapu areas anywhere in the world today. There's the fish that go no place to hide, no place to rest. And that's a problem. I mean, Rayathon, the fish finder company, their motto is the fish can run, but they can't hide.
Oh my God.
And that's our attitude. So, we really need to allow wildlife to, just what was it? The last few days, there's a video of a mountain lion stalking a person, Mountain lion wasn't stalking anybody. That mountain lion could have killed that guy if it wanted to. But it was saying, look, stay away. These are my cubs right here. Just back off, back off. So he kept pushing them to back off. Not once did that mountain lion attack. He just made, you know, a thing like this. Well, and then this guy goes on the internet saying, oh, my life is in jeopardy, you know, and everything. I was being stalked. It was such a frightening thing and everything like that. You know, people like that should stay out of the wilderness. You know, they don't belong there.
I saw that too. If your life's really in danger, you'd put your phone down and run.
Never run.
Yeah, never run.
Right. But actually, in the end, you know what turned him around? You know, she was a fair enough distance away from the cubs. But when he got down, he submitted.
Oh. You know,
he crouched down. And that's when, immediately when he went down, she turned around and walked away. Basically, what he was now telling her is, okay, I understand. You know,
wow.
He didn't think it that way, but from her point of view, it was, yeah, I understand. And then she went back to her cubs. That was all she wanted, was an admission that he understood what she was trying to do. And by crouching down like that, that was a submissive gesture.
Wow. I didn't think of it that way. I thought he threw a rock at her.
Well, that would have stopped
her. Yeah.
In fact, that actually is a very stupid thing to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Reminds me of the story a few years ago in Alaska. A bush pilot, you know, had shot a caribou, and he was cutting up the caribou, and a grizzly bear came on the scene and then proceeded to help himself to the caribou. And the guy went up a tree, and he was up the tree for 2 days. And I think it was a CBC interview. He was saying, well, you had a .45 pistol. Why didn't you shoot him? And the guy said, what, piss her off?
Exactly. Well,
there's a guy who knows what he's up against, you know. Just, you know, let it go. You know, you have to know what you can do and what you can't do. And, you know, people who are stupid enough to shoot a charging grizzly bear don't usually live to tell about the tale.
No, I would agree. You're not going to win fighting the bear. The odds are really good.
I've had face-to-face encounters with orcas, with lions, with grizzly bears, with sharks. I've swum with great white sharks and everything like that. I've never, ever felt threatened. The only place you ever felt threatened is walking through a dark street in some city in America.
Did you not feel threatened because you felt like you had an understanding with the animals? They knew that you weren't there to harm them?
Well, it's an understanding of their behavior. You get the signals from their behavior. And there's aggressive signals that they send, territorial signals that they send. You know, if a tiger shark is doing a circle around you and then suddenly goes into a rigid sort of posture, basically that tiger shark is saying, look, my territory, you can back off now, you know. And so you back off. You don't just do something stupid like go in and try and get its picture or something. You know?
You've had so many amazing experiences. Do you feel like you've led a rich life as you work to protect the planet?
Oh, yeah. I don't have any regrets on that. It's been an adventurous life. That's certainly true.
Were you locked up in Amsterdam for 80 days?
120 days.
120 days. What was that like?
Well, if you're going to go to prison anywhere, go to the Netherlands, really. It's like you might as well check into a, you know, luxury hotel. Get your own cell. I was in that cell for 23 hours out of 24, but I didn't really mind. But, you know, you can actually get your own refrigerator and order your own food. You can go to the gym, you can go play football, you can do all the, I mean, it's, you know, in fact, you could even escape. Now here's the thing. One guy did escape and I said, what's going to happen to you? Oh, nothing. I'll just bring him back. Well, aren't you charged with it? Isn't that a crime? No, here in the Netherlands. So we think it's a natural instinct for a person to escape captivity. And so we don't punish them for doing it. And that, well, I was there and I had a once a week press conference and the warden provided the coffee and the cookies.
Wow. Wow. Was that the highlight of this day?
I was actually, what was it? One magazine, the equivalent of Time magazine there, say, it described me as the only political prisoner in the Netherlands. But I was only there. I wasn't charged with anything. I was there to be, because Norway was demanding my extradition, but they lost and I wasn't extradited.
What were you doing the 23 hours a day in your cell? Were you reading books?
Reading, writing. I got a lot of letters, responding to those and everything. 1 hour a day, we got to go out and all the prisoners were in the same thing. And what we did was, well, a lot of these guys are from Africa. A lot of the prisoners are from Africa. And so, you know, we'd invest in certain, you know, so one person would buy rice and one person would buy this. And then these African guys would make a big dinner for everybody.
No way. Yeah. That's awesome. What was it like when you were on the run? You had to take a bunch of boats. You traveled around the world. They were looking for you with your Interpol red status. What was that like for you?
Well, I was able to cross the Atlantic and the Pacific, cross into Canada, cross over to the United States and make my way to America Samoa. So halfway around the planet without any papers, no passport, no papers at all. So I looked on it as a bit of an adventure. Went down to Antarctica, then spent a number of months in the southern, the South Pacific, in islands off of Tonga and Vanuatu, American Samoa, in different places. Yeah, it was great. You know, I spent a lot of time with turtles on the beaches in Vanuatu, or, you know, a lot of seabird places. There were some islands with one island, Rose Atoll. I must have had a million seabirds on this tiny island. You could walk around it in 10 minutes, but it had about a million seabirds on it.
Wow.
You know, it was an opportunity to get very close to nature in many, many ways. We spent a lot of time just collecting plastic on remote beaches and, you know, disposing of that. Every beach we found is just covered in plastic, like, in various places.
In the South Pacific, everywhere, nowhere doesn't happen.
I found no place. The only place that I haven't seen plastic is in Antarctica, because of the currents there keep everything north of those currents. So nothing really drifts down south there.
Wow. Was there times where you were in some sticky situations when you were on that big trip and people were looking for you?
I had to outmaneuver the U.S. Coast Guard when leaving the United States. You know, we just narrowly missed them picking us up off Catalina Island. But but the Bridge of Bordeaux is, you know, 30 knots, so it was pretty fast. We were out there pretty quickly. And I got into Canada, then I got into the U.S., and then I got out of the U.S. So.
You've had such an amazing life. I don't think I've read any of your books yet, but I'm going to look for them now.
Oh, okay. I'm working on a book now about that particular thing called Red Notice, about from leaving Germany to getting back to the U.S., you know, and that. So, yeah, actually, I have to say it was a lot of fun, really.
It seems like, how long was that? Like 12 months or 14 months or something?
Oh, from July of 2012 until... November of 2013.
Wow, what a crazy vacation. What's it been like writing about your experiences? Do you find it like a really good outlet for you to get it all out and be able to tell your stories?
Well, yeah, well, actually, I look on myself as a poet and a writer more than anything else. So, you know, throughout the 70s, I worked for the Georgia Strait and, you know, I did a lot of writing. And so I've written a number of books and a lot of poetry.
Did you get into writing because of your activism?
No, it's just been something I've done all my life.
Oh, that's so cool.
Where are you based?
I'm in Ucluelet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you guys had a Sea Shepherd boat in Tofino like a couple of years ago, I think.
Well, we were there in 93. Yeah, that was an interesting trip. We went there for the Clayquot thing, and... I remember coming in, that was that summer of everybody was like really, it was up in protest and that. And in fact, there's a great cartoon in the Times Colonist, you know, of all the guys with the with the picket signs saying, oh, here comes the RCMP. It says, oh, we don't care. Oh, here comes the loggers. Ah, we spit in their general directions. Here comes Paul Watson. They all run away. So all protesters. They hated me more. But here's what happened when I went to Ucluelet and to Tofino, is that I went in there and I came around the corner. It was about 200 loggers on the dock with picket signs protesting me. But I had a cannon on board and I just let it go, boom, like that. But there was not an end to the cannon. But they all hit the deck. It was really hilarious.
Oh my God!
But all of these environmental groups were there, and I got to meet with the tribe in Tofino with the Nechalna, and they couldn't figure out how come the Nechalna would meet with me, but they wouldn't meet with them, all the other environmental groups. But not only did I meet with the Nechalna, but I was under their protection while I was there. Oh. And the reason for that, even though the Nechalna were actually in disagreement with me on many things, the reason for that is that prior to going to Tofino, I wrote a letter to the tribal council asking for permission to come into their territory. So they hadn't done that. So because I had asked permission to come into the territory, I was also offered the protection while in that territory, you know. And so that was an interesting revelation there. But what was interesting is that when I was at the tribal council, the you know, they were saying they were again, because we'd spiked 20,000 trees on Mears Island. And they were attacking me for that. And I said, look, yeah, we spiked those trees on Mears Island, but there's three people up there on that tribal council right there. I won't mention their names who were part of that. So, you know, don't be worried, because they didn't know who it was, but they were there. So those guys sort of looked a little whatever. But and then what happened is in 92, we came into Ucuilute, and we were ordered into Ucuilute by the Mounties. We were coming back from the North Pacific Driftnet campaign, and I was ordered. Now, I didn't have to go into Ucuilute. We were on our way to Seattle. But I said, okay, well, I'm not going to argue with it. If you want me to come in, I'll come in. So we came in with we had two vessels. We came in, and they searched our vessel, all stem to stern, didn't find anything. But then when I went to leave, they gave me a bill for $7,000 for the pilotage fee. I said, look, I didn't ask to come in here. And I can go to Vancouver with a pilot fee for $1,000. How come I'm being charged $7,000? I think you're harassing me here. And they said, well, that's just what it is. I said, well, I'm not going to pay it. And they said, well, you have to pay us. No, I'm not going to pay it. And they won't be allowed to leave. So, okay, I'm not going to leave. And that night, the pilotage authority flew all the way up from Victoria to give me the bill personally. He says, you've got to pay this. No, I'm not going to pay it. No, you don't understand. If you don't pay this bill, you're not going to leave. Now, you don't understand. I'm not going to leave. I'm fine. I'm not going to pay the bill. So they didn't know what to do with that. But here's what they didn't know, is that I was going to retire the Sea Shepherd too. And so what I did is the next week, I stripped all the valuables off the vessel and put it on and took it to Seattle. And then I went into a bar, one of the bars in Ucuilute, I can't remember which one, and I sold the vessel for $5,000 to some guy. But that guy ended up dying in a kayak accident 6 months later. So now the vessel's sitting in Ucuilute. It sat there for 10 years.
What?
And they couldn't do a damn thing about it. And, you know, the people say, oh, you abandoned your ship. No, I didn't abandon it. I actually sold it to this guy. And they said, well, he died. Well, it's not my problem, is it? You know? And so it actually, one winter, it almost drifted away and almost broke up in the marina. And it caused all sorts of problems. It was just, finally, the government had to haul it away and scrap it down in Victoria at a cost of $500,000, you know? So that was what they did. But they also took me to court. They also took me to court for not paying the bill. So I just didn't show up.
Whoa.
And then what happened is the judge said, well, you know, that pilotage bill was for going in and for going out. But since he didn't go out, well, he only has to pay half of it, $3,500. I said, yeah, that's fine, but I'm not going to pay that either. So anyway, ended up costing the government $500,000 because they tried to harass me. And then the idiots did the same thing to me in, what was it, in 2008, when they seized the Barley Mowat, when I did what I was called Operation Tar Baby Farley, I called it. I don't know if you know the Brer Rabbit story.
I don't know about that one. I know Farley Mowat.
The Brer Rabbit story, these are Southern Black stories where Brer Rabbit is being hunted by Brer Bear and Brer Fox, and they finally catch him. And Brer Rabbit says, do anything to me, skin me alive, but don't throw me in the briar patch.
Oh, right.
So I sent the Farley, and I was under the Tar Baby Farley strategy. I wasn't on board it, but I... because I crewed it with Europeans, only Europeans. And I literally, I just threw it in the face of the fisheries minister. You don't dare seize my ship, you know, you know, try it, you know, if you think you're so. And he did, of course, he seized the ship, caused a big deal and everything like that, arrested all the crew just in time for us to put enough publicity into Europe to pass the bill to ban seal products. We needed that. And so what happened is that then they said, okay, the ship is going to be fined $75,000. I said, yeah, well, that's okay. Well, I'm not going to pay it. You can have it. No, no, you don't understand it. You know, no, that's okay. I was going to retire the ship anyway, so you just have it. And then they it cost $1 million to take care of that ship for the next year, because they had security guards, because they thought I actually insinuated I was going to steal it back.
Oh,
and they the guards and everything. And then they sold it at auction for $5,000.
No way.
And that guy took it to Lunenburg. And he ended up running up a $65,000 bill, and then he was an American, so he skipped town, didn't pay it. So they were stuck with it. And then they sold it to some other guy at auction, took it to Shelburne. That guy ended up not only skipping on the bill, but the boat sank at dockside because of water and everything else. And it cost the government $500,000 to raise it up and to clean it up. And then it ended up getting towed away at an incredible cost to be broken up. And because of that, it actually passed a law because, you know, people were abandoning ships all the time, but there's no law against it. But because of that, they got a law. So I said, see what we achieved. We got a law passed that you guys couldn't get passed because, you know, of your because of the politics of it, you know, how much you hate me, you ended up passing a law which benefits everybody. And I'm fine with that. But it wasn't our property, so we're not responsible. It was the government's property. They seized it. It was their property. They sold it. It's got nothing to do with me.
Wow. And it all started in Ucluelet.
Well, yeah, that particular thing. Yeah. well, there was one other incident in Tofino. This guy with a heavy German accent came up to me while I was talking to a reporter, and that was really funny. And he said, you know, you should go back to where you came from. So, well, I don't know, I came from Vancouver. And he said, you have no business here. So right in front of the camera, I said to him, how many Jews you kill in the war?
What?
And the reporter said, you can't say that. I said, sure I can. You know, I'm asking him a serious question. How many Jews you kill in the war? And he said, what are you talking about? I said, well, you were in the German army. Yeah, and I said, how many Jews did you kill in the war? And the reporter says, you can't ask him that. I said, yes, I can, because it's a legitimate question. I said, this guy was in the SS. And she said, well, what evidence do you have of that? He said, I was not. I said, what? And she says, what's the evidence? I said, look at his right hand. He doesn't have this finger, this trigger finger. Because SS soldiers, when the Russians caught them, they cut off that finger. If he was an officer, they would have shot him in the head. But the fact that this guy is the right age, without this finger, tells me he was in the SS.
No way.
He was still in the war. he took off. He got really pissed and took off.
That's crazy. Oh, my God. You were right. He did kill people in the war.
Well, I don't know if he killed Jewish people, but I know he must have. He was the SS, but, you know, it really was such and such.
Wow, that's so crazy. Because it seemed like such a crazy question that you asked him, and he, like, actually had his finger cut off. Wow.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the first thing I noticed when he did that.
Wow. That's a great story. I didn't know that they got their fingers cut off like that.
What's it like in Ucluelet these days?
It's way more expensive than when you were here. But it's still beautiful.
Two friends of mine owned the Wiccan Indian back in the 70s.
Oh, really?
Thurston and both were doctors, Myron McDonald. So we used to have some wild parties at the Wiccan Indian when they owned them.
So you used to have some wild parties there?
Yeah, those guys were both Greenpeace co-founders.
Cool. You must have been to so many parties in your day with all the, like, young activists. And...
Yeah, man, I wasn't big on parties.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I never really understood what the purpose of going to parties, really. I went to, like, a few of them. I remember one time went to one in 83 in Malibu with Dan Haggerty from Grizzly Adams. You know, he invited me to it. I was dancing with this girl, and this guy, I just remember he was wearing pink cowboy boots, and he cut in. I said, well, I was sort of here first. He said, well, that's my wife. I said, oh, okay. Well, that was Valerie Bertinelli, and that was Eddie Van Halen.
Hey, man, I was here first. Well, that's my wife.
Yeah.
That's so funny. Such big celebrities.
Yeah,
that was a big party memory that stood out.
But, well, the international chair of Sea Shepherd today is Pamela Anderson. She's living on Vancouver Island.
She lives back on Vancouver Island?
She's in Ladysmith.
Oh, no way. I should try to interview her.
Yeah, she probably would.
Oh, wicked. Yeah, I'll give her a try. But thanks so much, Paul. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I had a blast, and I'm so honored.
Oh, well, thank you. It's been a pleasure, then.
Hopefully I'll get to talk to you again one day, and all the best on your journey. And I'm really proud of what you've done already.
Oh, well, thanks.
You bet. All right. See you, Paul.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you. That was Paul Watson, founder of Sea Shepherd. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Their Life Story. My guest next week is Zach Shum. Zach is the founder.